Recording. All right, welcome everybody. Hello, this is Bio 231. It's February 22nd. It's a Wednesday, but it's the first lecture we have this week because Monday was a holiday, President's Day holiday. So we're going to keep on going. All right, so in lab you learned that we can take all the bones of the skeleton and break them down into two main categories. What are the two main categories of all the bones in your body? What can they fit into? Axial skeleton and appendicular skeleton, right? So axial skeleton is the skull, a bunch of bones there, vertebral column, rib cage, and sternum. Rib cage, sternum, and vertebrae in the back help make the rib cage or the thoracic cage, maybe is another way of saying it. And you can see that those are color-coded on this diagram, kind of in a gray color, so that is the axial skeleton, as opposed to appendicular skeleton, which are bones that make up your appendages, your upper appendage and your lower appendage. But we don't want to say arm and leg because where is your arm? Where's your arm? You could point or you could tell me it's between your shoulder and your elbow. Right, so your arm is leaving out your forearm and hands and all of that. And I don't want to say leg because where's your leg? It's between your knee and your ankle, so it's leaving out your thigh and your foot and all that kind of stuff, right? So that's why we like to say upper appendage and lower appendage. It's a little bit more inclusive. Okay, so those are the two main parts. And then we got some bones that help attach your appendicular to your axial skeleton. We'll look at those in a little bit. So you're going to certainly be familiar with all of these bones in quite a bit of detail, right? But maybe this is a good place to start maybe tonight, learning all of the bones on these figures right here that basically just show you the difference between axial and appendicular skeleton. All right, but before we can start talking about these bones, we need to know the scientific names for various landmarks that you find on bones. And that's what you see on the text slide over here on the right. Okay, the first thing is a rough raised spot on a bone. And a rough raised spot just means that the bone is growing, it's large, and it's rough because something is attaching to the bone with something very similar to those Sharpie's fibers that you're familiar with. All right, so it's going to be either a tendon or a ligament attaching to a bone if it's rough. All right, and that's an important kind of thing that we call a process. So a process is a rough raised area on a bone. And the function of that is for a muscle attachment or another bone attachment right there. And a muscle-to-bone connection is called a tendon. A bone-to-bone connection is called a ligament. And in every particular case, it's going to be dense, regular connective tissue. I just realized I got too many lights on here, so let's turn some of those lights off. Maybe you can see a little bit better now. Is that good? Better? Okay. So a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection. Nonetheless, that bone is going to be stressed and it's going to respond by getting bigger and stronger, right? And that's how we like to have our bones, big and strong, right? So exercise is always a good thing. Ligament is a bone-to-bone connection, but exactly the same kind of connective tissue. All right, so here are some special names of processes. So here's a list. Tubercles. A tubercle is a process. What's the function of a tubercle? What's the function? Okay, let's go back to the top. What's the function of a process on a bone? I mean, it's not a function. Okay, it's really a structure. It's for muscle attachment. All right, what's the function of a tubercle? Because a tubercle is a process. It's just a specific name of a process in a location in your body. So what's the function of a tubercle? Muscle attachment. What's the function of a tuberosity? Muscle attachment. All right, that's going to be a little bit smaller process, but it's going to be a rough raised area on a bone. All right, and then a trochanter. This is a very large, rough raised area on a bone. In particular, the femur. When we get to the femur, we're going to see some trochanters. What's the function of a trochanter? Muscle attachment. Yes. All right, then we have something called an epicondyle. What does epi mean? Above, and it's going to be above a condyle. A condyle is a rough, smooth area on a bone that we're going to discuss in a little bit. We did in lab already. But this is above a condyle, so it's not a condyle. It's really a process, and it's going to be a rough, raised area. So what's the function of an epicondyle? muscle attachment, right? Because these are all processes. All right, there's a special kind of process called the malleolus that we find in the ankles. And I would pronounce it like that. Some people say malleolus, you can say that. Maybe say it both ways so you really see how it's spelled, for instance, on a practicum. All right, then we have a crest. A crest is a process that's on an edge of a bone, and it's very long. So it's a rough area on a bone that's elongated on its edge. We're going to call that a crest. And a crest is a process. It just has a special, that special little shape. So what's the function of a crest? Muscle attachment as well. All right. Now, if you have a crest, and if it's in the middle of a bone, okay, then we're going to call it a spine. Some spines are long and narrow, and some are very short and narrow, but stick out quite a bit. All right, that's going to be a spine, like the styloid process is a spine. Okay, and what's the function of a spine on a bone? Muscle attachment. Like spinous process on vertebrae, that's for muscle attachment. And then a last one right here is a line. A line is not very prominent. It's a raised area, and it's rough, but it doesn't stick far above the bone. It's just kind of a small raised area on a bone, and it makes a line on that bone, so that's a process, and it's for muscle attachment as well. All right, so all of these things right here are for muscle attachment. All right, a depression or a bowl in a bone is what we call a fossa. And what do you do with a bowl at home? It holds something, right? So a fossa in your body is going to hold organs, or it's going to hold an artery or a nerve that passes very close to the surface of that bone. And we call that a fossa, especially if it's more round kind of depression. If it's a long depression, if it's kind of long and narrow, we call it a sulcus. But a sulcus and a fossa pretty much are the same thing, except the fossa is more circular. Sulcus is going to be long and narrow. And the same thing for a groove. Sometimes we use sulcus and groove interchangeably. All right, so what would be the function of a sulcus or a groove? It's for holding something. Some other structure is going to pass very close to a bone, and it's going to cause a depression. So it could be a depression for a long tendon that goes over the surface of a bone, or it could be for a blood vessel or a nerve that's going over a bone, and the bone gives way a little bit and makes that little depression right there. An alveolus is kind of a special depression, and it's more like a socket. All right, so an alveolus, think of like maybe, could be elongated, maybe for the root of a tooth to fit into a mandible or a maxilla. Okay, but an alveolus, maybe in your mind a more general term for alveolus should be more spherically shaped. But an alveolus in the mandible or maxilla is going to be matching up the root of a tooth. It won't be spherical. All right, that's for depression. Now, a hole in a bone, typically we call it a foramen, or foramina in plural, and that's a passageway. So that's a hole in a bone. So you've got a couple special passageways. If you have a passageway that's really long, and not going through just a thin part of a bone, but going through a big part of the bone, we call it a canal, right, if it makes more like a tunnel. If it's a very large, elongated hole in a bone, we call that a fissure. And some bones have holes in them, and we call it a sinus, right? And again, that's, you can think of that as almost like a very large alveolus. For instance, the paranasal sinuses and some cranial bones, facial bones, right? We're going to call that a sinus, but that's a cavity for holding like lymphatic tissue. Meatus. You have two meatuses in your body, and they're the internal and external acoustic meatus in the temporal bone. So that lets the external allow sound energy to enter the temporal bone, and the internal acoustic meatus allows nerves and blood vessels to enter the part of the temporal bone that's involved with hearing. All right, then one of the last things. Right, a smooth articulating surface on a bone. It's used for making joints where two bones come together, will rub up against each other. So these are when bones move against each other, not for instance, a suture that you have between cranial bones where those bones are touching each other, but they don't move. They're immovable. But we're talking about joints between bones that actually move. A good thing to know is a condyle. All right, so if you have a raised area on a bone that's articulating with another bone and these bones are moving all the time up against each other, do you think that should be a rough surface or a nice smooth surface? Smooth, so that these bones glide over each other, don't grind each other down. So that's the big difference between a condyle and a process, right? A process is going to be rough because something's going to be pulling on that area. Well, a condyle is just going to be slipping over another condyle. All right, the head of a bone is a condylar surface, but it's smooth. It's for articulation. Like the head of the femur, head of the humerus, head of the radius, even head of the ulna. These are all for articulations. They're going to be smooth surfaces. And if you have a condyle that kind of looks like a ball and it's going to rub up against a bone, then the other bone that it's rubbing up against shouldn't be like a ball, but it should be like a depression to accept the head of the bone that's going to rub up against it. And we call that a facet. All right, so facet is going to be nice and smooth. It's a depression, so I didn't know if I should put facet down here or put facet up over here in a depression. A facet is kind of like a special tiny little fossa. Could be put in either place. All right, some special kinds of articulating surfaces besides a head or a facet, you can have a trochlea and a capitulum. These are on the humerus, on the distal end of the humerus. These are special kinds of articulating surfaces because in your elbow, your humerus is in your arm, and the distal epiphysis of the humerus makes the elbow. The elbow is kind of a fancy joint. It can act like a door. It can swing open and close. But there's something else you can do with the elbow. Yeah, you can twist your wrist, right? That's also an articulation that happens in the wrist, so you need special articulating surfaces to allow for something we call pronation and supination. And when we get to muscles, we'll start to talk about what some of these different motions are. All right, so trochlea and capitulum. All right, there's another thing called a ramus. And a ramus is a part of a bone that makes a 90-degree bend. For instance, a good example would be your mandible. The body of the mandible is horizontal, but there's another part that makes a 90-degree bend and goes up to meet the temporal bone to form the temporomandibular joint. So that part of the mandible that's sticking straight superiorly is called the mandibular ramus compared to the body. All right, so these are some terms that you have to know, but probably in your mind you should have an example and maybe a picture of where you could find some of these things on various bones. All right, so now I can start to actually use some of that terminology to talk about the skeleton. All right, so remember, the skeleton can be broken down into two main regions, the axial skeleton and appendicular. I'm not ever going to ask you how many bones make up the skull, but if you're interested, you see that there's 28. You've got one bone that's tucked away inside the mandible, that's the hyoid bone. A number of bones that make up the vertebral column, you see there's 26. And then there's 25 bones that make up the thoracic cage, including the ribs. All right, so this is where we're going to start. But don't forget, the other part of the skeleton, which we're going to talk about probably next time, are what? For the upper and lower appendages. And then also girdles that help attach the upper appendage to the axial skeleton. Right, and the lower appendage to your axial skeleton. All right, so let's start looking at the skull. You have a number of bones in the skull. Well, I tell you what, before you look at that, just like the whole skeleton can be broken up into two main regions, the bones of the skull can be broken up into two main regions, and that is bones that make up the face and bones that make up the cranium. All right, so these are cranial bones right here. A cranial bone is just a bone that protects the brain. Delicate nervous tissue. Facial bones are just bones that are there for articulation, which is communication, for breathing, and for eating. Right? So those are what we call facial bones. You should probably have an example or be able to take a bone and break it into those two different places. All right, if we cut the top of the head off, does anybody know what the top bone? It's a top portion of the skull. It's partly made out of the frontal bone, partly of parietal, and a little bit of the occipital bone. What is that structure called? It's not really a bone, it's an artificial structure. It's called the calvarium, right? I mentioned that in the lab. So if we take the calvarium off and look into the cranium, into the cranial vault, we can see that there are some depressions. So here's a depression in the frontal bone. We call this the anterior cranial fossa for holding the anterior lobes of the brain. Then there's the middle cranial fossa, mostly made up of the temporal bones here and here. That's for holding the temporal lobe of the brain. And then here is the posterior cranial fossa, and it holds the, guess what lobe of the brain this is? You haven't studied it, you won't study it for a month or 2 months, but remember, we name the parts of the brain by the bones that are holding it. And what bone is this down over here? Occipital bone, so that would be the occipital lobe, right, of the brain in this region. So in lab, see if you can find these three different fossa. Oh, and look at these cool foramina that we can see. We could probably name these things right now as a practice for lab, like what the olfactory foramina in the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone that we have right here. And then we have the optic canal. And then what are these three? You got foramen rotundum, foramen ovale, foramen spinosum, just in that order. Then you can fall down into this another depression right here, that's foramen lacerum. And then over here, you got the external acoustic meatus. So right here is the internal acoustic meatus. So this big one, a little bit further down in this region here, that's a jugular foramen. And then the last two, you got foramen magnum and hypoglossal canal. So this is a pretty good diagram, okay, for you to practice with. And actually, you should be able to draw those foramina out. All right, so those are the, this is just pointing out the three major cranial fossae. All right, so what about cranial bones? Let's see if we can find some cranial bones to look at. Nice cranial bones. Here's a good place to start. Nice lateral view. This is a quiz in lab. So you should be able to identify each of these cranial bones. All right, so frontal. What lobe of the brain is right underneath the frontal bone? Frontal lobe, right? So it really pays big dividends for students to learn their bones very well in anatomy because you learn a lot of neuro and muscle anatomy and vascular anatomy at the same time. So frontal, parietal, occipital. These are all flat bones that develop from what? Intramembranous ossification. We learned that in the last chapter, along with all the other bones in the skull, including the temporal bone that we have right here. Here's that nice sphenoid bone that goes all the way across from one side of the head to the other, makes up the posterior aspects of this orbit. Right, so an orbit is just a huge fossa that a eyeball fits into. That's what we call an orbit. All right, so those are important cranial bones. What we can't see very well, which is an important cranial bone, is what? The ethmoid that has the cribriform plate and the crista galli and all those olfactory foramina in it. Okay, here's that nice sphenoid. What about a cranial? What's another cranial bone? Okay, I think that's probably, well, it's probably good for right now. So let's look at some facial bones, all right, including the mandible, right, your lower jawbone. It's got a number of pieces. Here's the body. Here's the ramus. What's a ramus? It's just a bone that makes a 90-degree bend compared to the body, and where it bends is what we call the angle. The mandible has a couple foramina. Here's the mental foramen. This region is the mental region of the mandible. And there's another foramen that we can't see. Anybody remember another one in the mandible? And it's on the medial surface. We're looking at the lateral surface of the mandible. The medial surface is on the inside, and right about in this region on the medial surface is the mandibular foramen. A lot of you guys will be working with that nerve that's coming out of the mandibular foramen for the rest of your lives. For instance, if you work in a dental office, that's a nerve that innervates this region right here, so whenever these teeth get worked in, that's a nerve that needs anesthesia. So you need to be able to feel where that foramen is and inject anesthetic right into it intraorally. All right, so here's the mandible, lower jawbone. Here's the upper jawbone or the maxilla. All right, and the maxilla and mandible have something in common. It has a fossa in common. What kind of fossa or depression does the maxilla and mandible have? It's called an alveolus, right? It's a special kind of fossa that a tooth fits in. So here is the margin of an alveolus, and then here's a little alveolar process between the alveoli. And there are ligaments that go from the mandible to a tooth or the maxilla to a tooth from these different processes, right, that hold a tooth in place. So here is an example of a process that's not for muscle attachment necessarily, but also for ligament, a bone-to-bone connection, right, if we want to consider a tooth a bone. All right, what else do we see with this maxilla? Oh, here is the infraorbital foramen, because an orbit is an eye socket. Here is a nice zygomatic bone that helps make the cheekbone. And in lab, what kind of struck you about the zygomatic bone in terms of its size? It's small. It's a small bone, but it's a very prominent facial feature, right? It really stands out, even though it's a very small bone. Okay, and it helps make up the zygomatic arch. So here's a zygomatic arch. What are the two bones that come together to make the zygomatic arch? It is the zygomatic bone and the temporal bone. Here's a process on the temporal bone that helps make up the zygomatic arch. And remember, when we name processes in the skull, and it's a kind of a nomenclature that we typically use, even when we get to appendicular skeleton, all right, we name this process not after the bone that it exists on, but by the name of the bone that it articulates with, right? So here's a nice suture between the zygomatic and temporal bone. So this would be not the temporal process, but the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. And it's not labeled, probably not labeled in lab for you either. But here is a process of the zygomatic bone. What would you call this process on the zygomatic bone? Yeah, because it's touching the temporal bone, that would be the temporal process of the zygomatic. And then here's another process on the zygomatic bone. What's it touching up here? The frontal bone, so you would call this the frontal process of the zygomatic bone, right? And indeed, this is probably something you do have to know for lab. Here is a process on the maxilla. Would you call this the maxillary process of the maxilla? I would wish for you not to name it that. What would you call it? It's touching the frontal bone, so what would you call this process? That's the frontal process of the maxilla, okay? All right, so we're going to use that nomenclature a lot. So here is a nice condylar surface. What's the function of a condylar surface? It forms an articulation, so it would be smooth, and the joint that it actually makes, right, because this is the mandibular condyle, it fits into the mandibular fossa of the temporal bone, so it helps make what? The temporomandibular joint, or TMJ. We just call it TMJ. That's a really fancy joint, if we get to talk about it when we talk about joints. Here is a coronoid process. What's the function of this coronoid process? It's not for articulation. Muscle attachment. So muscles that come down from the cranium attach right here. When they contract, it elevates the mandible for chewing, for instance. Okay, then we got some other processes right here. Big massive process, mastoid process and styloid process. Big strong muscles in your neck attached to the mastoid process that stabilize your neck. Prevent those cervical vertebrae from becoming damaged or twisted unnecessarily. Okay, when we get to muscles, we'll get to know some of those muscles right away. Mastoid process. Then, you got some sutures, right? And these sutures are immovable joints. There's only one movable joint in the skull. What's the one movable joint in the skull? You don't have to tell me the name. You could just tell me the acronym. The TMJ, yeah, temporomandibular joint right here. This is the only joint that moves. The rest are what we call sutures. They're immovable joints, right? So a nice squamosal suture, lambdoid suture, occipital mastoid. And remember, you can combine mastoid region with occipital region right here as long as you put an O between them, and that completely describes where this suture is. Some other facial bones. We have a nasal bone articulating with a frontal bone. So on the bridge of the nose is a nasal bone. What would you call this suture right here between the nasal bone and frontal bone? That would be the nasofrontal suture or frontal nasal suture, either way. Okay. So that's just some nice nomenclature that you should be aware of. And then here is that meatus, external acoustic meatus, for allowing sound energy to enter the temporal bone, because your receptors for sound are in the temporal bone. When we get to senses, we'll look at some detail with those things. Okay, also on this diagram, here is the ethmoid bone. That's a cranial bone that helps make up the orbit. So don't forget to look at your pre-lecture reading assignments, because I think I have some questions in there that says, what's the lower jawbone? And you should be able to name that. Mandible. What's the upper jawbone? Maxilla. That sounds kind of funny because you don't really think of that part of your face as being a jaw, but it makes sense. But then I ask you, what bones make up the orbit right here? So you should have that on the tip of your tongue. All right, and you can also, you can look that up in your book, Wikipedia it, right? Or look at my answer key that should be popping open today at 10:30. But it's what, like the frontal bone, the zygomatic bone, ethmoid, sphenoid, lacrimal bone make up the orbit. And I also want you to know bones that make up the nasal cavity. So what kind of bones do you see here? Nasal bone, maxilla. I heard somebody say vomer, which I haven't shown you yet, but from lab, you kind of know about the vomer. It makes up the inferior part of the nasal septum. There's a little bit of a spur maybe I can see on this diagram right here. Palatine bone and maxilla. All right, so try to piece those bones together. You get some pretty good pictures in your book. All right, so those are facial bones and cranial bones. There's some bones I didn't even talk about in lab just yet. I say three tiny bones, and I could have all three bones right between my fingertips, between my thumb and my index finger right here. And you couldn't say that I don't have them. Because why? Because they're so small, all three would fit right between my fingertips. And they're called the malleus, incus, and stapes. And they're right between the external acoustic meatus and internal acoustic meatus. All right, and they're important bones for hearing. They help assist in the sense of hearing. All right, so they're important for hearing inside the temporal bone. And the other bone that's inside of another bone, but not completely surrounded by it, is a hyoid, which we can't see on this diagram, but it kind of is horseshoe-shaped like the mandible and actually inserts up inside the mandible. Some other bones, nasal conchae. Let me see if I can find some nasal conchae. I think we got some pretty good pictures of nasal conchae. Yeah, here's a nice anterior view, right? We can see the orbits right here, the supraorbital foramen, infraorbital foramen, supraorbitals in the frontal, infraorbitals in the maxilla. All right, you can see the sphenoid bone now going across, making up that inferior part of the orbit. All right, but looking inside the nasal cavity, we see that it has separations and has little shells inside the nasal cavity, and you can see the bridge of the nose right here, the nasal bone. All right, so whenever you have a separation between chambers in the body, we like to name that a septum. So here is a nasal septum. It's separating the right and left nostrils from each other, but your heart has chambers that are separated by these walls. We call those septa as well, or septums. All right, so the superior part of the nasal septum is made out of the ethmoid bone, and the inferior part is made out of that vomer that somebody was talking about. It's a really long, narrow, thin bone. The ethmoid bone kind of looks like an E lying down on its side. All right, the other things that I see are these wings or shelves inside the nasal cavity. These are what we call nasal conchae. Here is the inferior nasal conchae. Here is the middle nasal conchae, and what you cannot see is the superior nasal conchae. The inferior is a bone all by itself, but the middle and superior nasal conchae are part of the ethmoid bone. And they have important functions because they air condition the air as it's flowing in. If the air is cold, it warms the air up so you don't freeze your lungs. If the air is really hot, it cools the air down so you don't burn your lungs. Or if the air is really dry, it helps humidify the air so you don't turn your lungs into potato chips, right? So it performs a number of important functions that way. But another important function is that it orders the air. It organizes the air as it flows into your nasal passageways so that it flows nice and smoothly without a lot of resistance. If there were a lot of turbulence in the air, it'd be really hard to breathe. It would be high resistance. So these little shelves and septations allow the air to flow in nice and smooth. Maybe you've kind of done that. Have you ever taken a bottle of something, maybe wine or Coca-Cola, and you want to empty that bottle into a glass without spilling a lot of stuff? Do you like turn it upside down in a hurry and let a lot of bubbles and a lot of turbulence? Or do you start pouring it so it's nice and smooth flow? If it's nice and smooth, it flows really fast and easy, right? If there's a lot of bubbles in it, right, it takes a long time to do that. Get your stopwatch out and check that out sometime. But I think you can see what I'm saying. That's what these things are in the nose for. Okay, so we see the optic canal. We saw that in the sphenoid bone, one of the first slides from the cranial vault. But the back of the orbit also has some other larger foramina. Here's the superior orbital fissure between the greater and lesser wings of the sphenoid bone, right? And that's a fissure because it's a foramen, but it's what? It's elongated, so it's a fissure. And then here's the inferior orbital fissure. Again, it's not just a foramen, but it's an elongated foramen. Okay, so I think that's all I want to talk about with regard to some of these bones, but in lab you get to play around with all these different bones. Cavities, okay, so cavities are just holes inside bones, and in the skull there's some important cavities. You have some pretty good pictures in your book as to, here's a nice picture of that hyoid. I showed you that in lab. All right, look, where are these sinuses at? I know they're here. Okay, so there are four paranasal sinuses. If you look at the frontal bone, there is kind of a prominent ridge right here in this location. It's called the glabella. And deep to the glabella are some pockets deep inside the bone. That's a paranasal sinus. And so what would we call this paranasal sinus in the frontal bone? It's a frontal paranasal sinus, right? Okay. Here is a maxilla in this region right here. And here's another big sinus. This is probably the biggest one. This is the maxillary paranasal sinus because it's in the maxilla. And then in the ethmoid bone, it's loaded with all kinds of little sinuses, right? And so those would be called the ethmoid sinuses, and they're a paranasal sinus. And then in the sphenoid bone, deep inside the body of the sphenoid bone is a cavity as well, and so that would be the sphenoid paranasal sinus. And when we say paranasal, that means what? It's associated with the nasal cavity. So there are foramina that attach or connect the paranasal sinuses to the nasal cavity, so air can actually get into these cavities unless they're filled with fluid, for instance, when you have a cold or any kind of sinus congestion. Right, and these pockets right here are filled with lymphatic tissue. And what's the job of lymphatic tissue? Yeah, it's part of your immune system, part of your immune response to protect you from infection, because we're breathing in pathogens all the time, either through our mouth or through our nose, and this lymphatic tissue helps fight those infections, helps keep those bacteria from taking over our body. Okay. All right, cranial cavity, we talked about nasal cavity, oral cavity, that's pretty easy to tell. All right, who's got a question about the skull? In lab, you get to play with some detail with this, and don't forget the disarticulated bones. You have a little practice quiz online that's a video that shows these disarticulated bones, right? So you should probably know, like, if you see something like that, that's a nice sphenoid bone. Okay, so we can go over like the lesser wing and greater wing. What do we have in the sphenoid bone? Optic canal. And then here is a fossa for holding the pituitary gland, which is a very important gland in your body. So, and it has a particular shape, so we call it the sella turcica. It reminds somebody of a saddle that you would put on a horse to ride that horse, particularly a style that we would find in Turkey or Turkestan or someplace over there. Okay, and so it's called the sella turcica. So your legs would come out over here and you'd have these little horns to work with. All right, you can also see some of the other foramina like ovale rotundum, ovale, and spinosum over here. Okay, in the optic canal. Those are all in the sphenoid bone. What are some other bones? What other bones you should be familiar with? Oh, mandibles, pretty easy to see. Ah, ethmoid bone. Let's look at that one. Ethmoid bone. It kind of forms an E. So here's one part of the E. Here's the horizontal part. Maybe an E would be sitting on this. This would be the base. Here's the vertical part. Then here's the middle part of the E. And then here is the top part of the E. Right? And this perpendicular plate, the middle part of the E, makes the superior part of the nasal septum. And then right above that is the cranium. So the cribriform plate is here and here. There are holes in the cribriform plate that allow olfactory nerves to get into the nasal cavity for the sense of, what sense would that be? I maybe heard the right answer. Maybe, maybe, maybe. It's what? Starts with an O. Olfaction, yeah, olfaction. You could say smell, but olfaction would be better. Okay, those would be the olfactory foramina. Then here's the chrysogale that holds the strong membrane that surrounds the brain. So the chrysogale is really nice because it's holding your brain so that when you turn your head, your brain doesn't slosh around inside your cranium. That's really handy. And don't forget, all of these paranasal sinuses, sometimes we call these ethmoidal air cells, it fights infection, allows you to breathe. So the ethmoid bone is probably everybody's favorite bone in here, okay, because it does all these really cool things for us. Okay. Temporal bone, you probably know a lot about already from lab. All right. What kind of cavity? Do you have a cavity in this maxilla right here? How about the maxillary paranasal sinus? Yeah, make sure in lab you see that nice big sinus deep inside the bone. So the maxilla, here's that nice frontal process. You can see the alveolar margins. Here's that zygomatic process. Because what bone is the zygomatic process of the maxilla touching? That's it right there in the name, yeah. The zygomatic bone, right? So, and then here is a nice orbital surface, or sometimes, what do we have this listed as in lab? Not necessarily orbital surface, but it is the orbital plate, right? The orbital plate, orbital surface are the same things. So the frontal bone has an orbital surface or orbital plate inside the orbit. And the zygomatic bone does, and the ethmoid bone does as well. Oh, that's another function of the ethmoid bone. Helps form an orbit, so it's involved with seeing or vision. So that's hugely important for all of us. All right, this right here shows us, you see the nasal bone. All right, here's the nasal septum, and we can see the two bones that make up the nasal septum, for instance, the ethmoid bone superiorly and the vomer inferiorly. What else? Here's a sphenoid bone. Here's a cella turcica, and right below the cella turcica, here is the sphenoid paranasal sinus, right smack in the middle of the head. All right. Also, what I see in this diagram is the upper jawbone or maxilla. Right now, here's that incisive foramen, kind of right between your two incisors. And here is a horizontal plate that makes the hard palate of your mouth or the roof of your mouth. And, of course, that's bone. That's why we call that the hard palate. And we call this the palatine process. Palatine process because what bone is it articulating with? The palatine bone. What shape is that palatine bone? Kind of L-shaped, right? So my thumbs would make up the hard palate. That's the inferior part of the palatine bone. And we're going to call that the horizontal plate. And then the vertical plates of the palatine bone make up the walls of the nasal cavity right here. Perpendicular plate as opposed to horizontal plate. The other thing I notice right here are the nasal conchae. So here's the inferior, here's the middle, right, and here's the superior. So superior and middle are part of the ethmoid bone, and the nasal conchae, or the inferior nasal conchae, is just the bone all by itself. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to say about some of these skull bones. Vertebrae. What part of the skeleton are these? Appendicular or axial? Axial skeleton. All right, so they go all the way from the region in your neck, that's the cervical region, all the way down, okay, into your pelvic region. So here's the sacrum. So the sacrum is actually part of the axial skeleton. And you see that most of these vertebrae right here have numbers, right? The most superior within a division is number one. The most inferior is going to be the largest number. So we're starting from superior and number them to the inferior region. In the neck, these are cervical vertebrae. The ones that make up the thoracic cage are thoracic vertebrae, and then below those are the lumbar, and then we have the sacral. And what do you notice about the sacral vertebrae? Something strange is going on here. They're all fused together, right? And in a normal young spine, none of the other vertebrae are fused together except for the coccygeal vertebrae, which are just vestigial vertebrae from when our ancestors way back when in antiquity actually had a tail. Okay, those are the coccygeal. So you have 7 cervical, 12 thoracic, 5 lumbar. That's easy to remember because when do you have breakfast? At 7. And when do you have lunch? At 12. And when do you have supper? At 5, right? So that will help you remember how many vertebrae you have. It doesn't mean that every single person has that exact number. It's pretty standard. Thoracic region has a little bit more variability. We might find somebody in this building that only has 11, okay? Maybe not in this class, but maybe somebody in this building or on campus. So there's some anatomic variation. It's not really an abnormal condition. It's just different compared to everybody else. All right. The interesting thing about these thoracic vertebrae is that in order to be a thoracic vertebrae, there has to be something attached to it. And what is that? It's got to have a rib, right? So this particular person that has 12 thoracic vertebrae, how many pairs of ribs do they have? They've got to have exactly 12, right? But if they're the person that has 11 thoracic vertebrae, how many pairs of ribs do they have? Then they have to have exactly 11. It's got to match up exactly, right? And if for some reason you have 7 thoracic vertebrae, how many pairs of ribs do you have? 7. I've never seen that. I wouldn't expect anybody to see that. That's too large of a anatomic variation. Okay. What about this L1 right here? Does that have a rib attached to it? L1. Does L1 have a rib attached to it? No. Because otherwise it would be what? It would be T13. Right? Okay. If it did. All right, so we don't always say the division by its word. We can abbreviate it by saying C for cervical, T for thoracic, L for lumbar, right? S for sacral. What about coccygeal right here? We can't say C because what does C stand for? Cervical. Oh my goodness. What are we going to do? We abbreviate it CO for coccygeal. Fortunately, that's not a huge clinical issue because the coccyx is not really too important. Unless you break it, then it's a pain in you know where. Okay. Okay, I see some curvatures. Do we have to talk about curvatures? Yeah, a little. Okay, curvatures. Okay. The cervical curvature, I tell you what, let's start with a thoracic curvature. It's a posterior curvature. See how the spine curves posteriorly? So the body of these vertebrae are anterior, the spinous processes are posterior to give you a little orientation. So the thoracic curvature is a posterior curvature because what is it accommodating? It's actually, you could almost think of it as like a fossa right here, this curvature, because it's accommodating vital organs that you have, like your heart and your lungs. They have to have a space to fit, so your vertebral column deviates posterior in that direction, okay? So a lot of your body is posterior, but to maintain balance, what do you have to do with other parts of your body? If some parts of your body are hanging way posterior, in order to maintain balance, what do you have to do? Move other parts anterior to balance it out, right? So the cervical curvature right here positions your head a little bit anterior to balance out all the weight that is posterior in the thoracic region. Okay, and the same thing for the lumbar curvature. It's an anterior curvature, just like the cervical curvature right here, just to help you maintain your balance so that you're not always falling forward or backwards, for instance. And then there's another posterior curvature in the sacral and coccygeal region right here, and guess what that's for? To hold important pelvic organs, Okay, part of your digestive system, but for instance, uterus and urinary bladder as well. All right, so this all kind of, these all kind of work together so that you contain, so you can maintain balance and it can support your body weight. Okay, there are some abnormal curvatures, kyphosis, exaggerated thoracic curvature. All right, so it's going to be a posterior curvature that's exaggerated right here. Sometimes we call that a humpback. Lordosis, exaggerated lumbar curvature. So here is the lumbar curvature. That's an anterior curvature. All right, sometimes we call that sway back. And you notice that in horses quite a bit, right? If they've been ridden really hard, their vertebrae kind of slump down a little bit. That would be a lordosis. And scoliosis, so both kyphosis and lordosis are an anterior-posterior abnormal curvature, but a scoliosis is a lateral curvature. So instead of being straight up and down, okay, the spine can bend to the right or to the left. That's another abnormal curvature. And some of these curvatures can develop because of a process we call osteoporosis. Right? Other conditions can produce those abnormal curvatures, but osteoporosis can. And what is osteoporosis? Have you ever heard of osteoporosis? It's when your bones get brittle because they're lacking calcium, the hydroxyapatite that gives bones strength. Okay? And that's a process, and it's kind of a strange process because it will help, it will affect almost everybody in here if we're lucky enough to live old enough. All right? So we got to be lucky to get that pathological conditions because we got to be old. And I say it's kind of a strange process because it's very rare for a disease to affect everybody in the population, right? I know there's a cold going around right now, maybe a flu, but are we all going to come down with this cold or flu? Some of us are just going to be resistant to it. Because if you look around the room, what can you tell me when you look around the room? Do you see another you when you look around? We're all different, right? So we all have different abilities to withstand various disease processes, but osteoporosis is not one of them. And that's just because as we get older, our body has difficulty absorbing calcium from our diet and incorporating it into bones. And we need calcium for so many other processes in our body besides making strong bones that when we're low on calcium, your body goes to bones to get it in order for other things to function properly. And we'll talk about some of those other processes throughout the whole class. Anybody have an idea where calcium, where else calcium is necessary in your body to maintain health besides bones? ATP. Usually there has to be calcium or magnesium to activate ATP. Okay. That's kind of a molecular understanding of it. ATP is an energy source, so you can't really access that energy source unless you have some calcium ions or magnesium ions around in your body. But something else is real important. Every muscle contraction is dependent on calcium. Okay, so if you had to make a choice of where you wanted proper levels of calcium, would you say in your muscles so they contract or in your bones to make them strong? If that was your choice. Muscle. Your body makes that same choice too. So when you're low on calcium, what happens to your bones? They go away so that you can maintain muscle contraction. They're also important for nerve conduction. All right, so it's a way of controlling your body. So what's more important for you, do you think, for calcium in order to maintain consciousness and be able to think or to have strong bones? To think or have strong bones? Think. And guess where your brain goes to get calcium when it's low on calcium. Bones makes them weaker, right? So you make that same choice your body does. So to protect yourself from osteoporosis, you should have good calcium in your diet, right? And also vitamin D that allows you to absorb calcium from the calcium that you eat. And the other thing is, what kind of tissue is bone? What kind of tissue is bone? It's connective tissue. And is it living or dead? Is living. How can you convince me it's living? What does it have? Yeah, because a cell is the base structural and functional unit of life, and you could tell me what kind of cells it has. What kind of cells does it have? It's got osteocytes, and when it's growing, it has osteoblasts, and when it's hollowing out a region in the body, it has osteoclasts. It's loaded with living cells, so it's a living tissue, right? And if you stress a bone, it will grow and get stronger. All right, so if you exercise premenopausally, have good calcium and vitamin D in your diet, you can actually make your bones bigger and stronger. That protects you from osteoporosis. Whether you're male or female, it really doesn't matter. But females are a little bit more sensitive to that, okay? But if you're a person that has big bone structure, you're going to be somewhat protected from osteoporosis. If you're a person that has a small bone structure, you're going to be more sensitive to osteoporosis later on in your life. But how can you protect yourself? What are the three ways?
Exercise.
Vitamin D. And calcium. So diet and exercise. And we're going to see that diet and exercise is important for almost every aspect of your body, which is probably the biggest reason why people hate this class. Because what are the best ways to maintain your healthy body? Diet and exercise. It's like the last thing we want to hear. Okay. Okay. So these bones, the vertebral bodies right here, compress upon each other, right? But it's not a bone-to-bone joint. There should be some cartilage that protects that joint. And that is fibrocartilage. This is what we call an intervertebral disc. Right, so that's the strongest kind of cartilage. Doesn't mean it can't get damaged. It can't get damaged because the interior part of an intervertebral disc is a weaker kind of connective tissue, more of a liquid kind of connective tissue. That's called the nucleus pulposus. Here it is. Right, and then here is the annulus fibrosus. This is the fibrous cartilage right here. If you twist your back inappropriately or compress it inappropriately, this stuff can squirt out posteriorly or even anteriorly, but mostly posteriorly, and it can then compress a nerve that's trying to leave this foramen right here. Does anybody remember what this foramen is between the vertebrae that allow these spinal nerves to leave the spinal cord? The big hole is what? The vertebral foramen for the spinal cord. But the hole between vertebrae is called the intervertebral foramen, right? So here's that intervertebral disc, and here's that intervertebral foramen. Sometimes that intervertebral disc can actually impinge upon the nerve right here. Okay. And so you all know the basic parts of a vertebrae because we go over that in lab, like the body is here. Transverse process, spinous process. Here is a superior articulating process with an articulating facet right here for the vertebrae that is superior to it. And on the inferior aspect of a vertebrae, you would see the inferior articulating process and facet for articulating with this particular vertebrae right here. Okay. How would you tell the difference between a cervical and lumbar vertebrae? How would you recognize a cervical vertebrae? What does a cervical vertebrae have? What does cervical vertebrae have? Anybody remember from lab? Some of the Monday group may be a little bit rusty because you didn't have class this week. It's got what? Transverse foramina. That's a characteristic of cervical vertebrae. The spinous process, if we look on the inferior side, you're going to see is what? Bifurcated. It has two points coming out. All right, and this is the only region where vertebrae have special names. C1 and C2 have special names because they have special functions. And the name for C1, think of it as a mythical god holding up the world, that is Mr. Atlas. All right, and then C2 is not named after a mythological figure, but it's named after the body of C1 that got stuck to the body of C2. Actually, we want to say fused. The body of C1 has fused to the body of C2, forming like an axle, right? It's a projection that C1 can actually rotate around, all right? So therefore, we call C2 the axis because that's what allows for rotation. Between C1 and C2 is rotation only, okay? Between C1 and the bone above, what's the bone above C1? It's a skull bone. That's the occipital bone. That kind of motion is only what we call flexion and extension, but not rotation. That joint won't allow for rotation, right? And if those motions are performed, if rotation is performed between occipital bone and C1, that's going to cause a fracture of C1. That's not a good thing, right? Or flexion and extension between C1 and C2 will fracture C2, right? Because only rotation is allowed. So we could go over that. Between C1 and occipital bone, what's the motion? Yes or no? Yes. And between C1 and C2, what's the motion that's allowed? No. Which is correct answer. Okay. All right, so that's cervical vertebrae. What about lumbar vertebrae? What do they have? Where do we have some? Here you can see the nice articulation between C1 and C2. Here is the dens. Sometimes it's called the odontoid process. Nice transverse ligament that stabilizes this anterior part, okay, of the cervical neck. And then you can see the bifurcated spinous processes. All right. The thoracic vertebrae. What does a thoracic vertebrae have attached to them besides another vertebrae? It's got to have ribs of some kind, okay? And a rib is going to articulate on the body. I see it right here. This is a costal facet and also on a transverse process, so a rib is going to come around and touch both of these locations. So here is a nice smooth depression that we call a facet for articulating with a rib. In lab, you'll be able to see that really, really nicely. All right, so rib. Let's talk about ribs a little bit. We've got how many pairs of ribs? Yeah, I got 12. Okay, here's a nice diagram of some ribs right here. So there's 12 from superior to inferior. Most of the ribs have a costal cartilage off their anterior tip right here, and that costal cartilage articulates with the sternum. We haven't talked about the sternum yet, but here is the breastbone or the sternum. It's made out of three bones, the manubrium superior, the body in the middle, and xiphoid process down here. We talked a lot about this in lab. All right, but here's that costal cartilage. And if a rib has a costal cartilage that attaches directly to the sternum, we call that a true rib. So number one does. What about number two? Goes directly to the sternum. Number three, four, and five goes directly to the sternum. Six, it's a little bit longer, but it still goes directly to the sternum. And even number seven, that's really long, but it still goes directly to the sternum. So those are all true ribs. If we look at number eight, which is this one right here, see its costal cartilage, where does it go? It only goes to the cartilage of number seven. It doesn't go all the way to the sternum. So that's a false rib as a result. So the inferior five, each of these inferior five, do not directly attach to the sternum. So these are what we call false ribs. 1 through 7 are true, right? 8 through 12 are false. And then the other thing that we notice is that the most inferior two, so that would be 11 and 12 right here, don't have any cartilage at all. All right, so these are what we call floaters. And since they don't attach directly to the sternum, they're also false ribs. So floaters are false ribs, right, for that particular reason. Okay, and in lab we talk about the particular parts of a rib, but maybe we could go over some parts of a rib. Okay, here is the sternal end that has costal cartilage that's going to go to the sternum. Here's the vertebral end of a rib that's going to articulate with the vertebral body. So these are facets for articulation with the vertebral bodies. Then there's a little narrowing. Guess what we call a narrowing? Oh, here's the narrowing. Sorry, here's the narrowing. We call that the neck. So here is the head, which is kind of broad. Here's that narrow region we call the neck. And then it kind of broadens out again. This is a tubercle, because this is what's going to articulate with the transverse process of a rib. This is what's going to articulate with the vertebral body. So let's take, let's take a look and then I can come back. All right, so here is the head of a rib articulating with the demifacets right here and right here on the vertebral body. And then here's the tubercle, right, that's articulating, and I can't see the transverse process back here very well from this rib right here, but there's going to be an articulation. Let me see if I see, here, better yet. All right, so here's the head of the rib articulating with the vertebral body. Here's the tubercle that articulates with the transverse process, right, and in particular, right near that costal facet. All right, what are some other things about the rib? Here is the angle of the rib. Here's the shaft. And if we look at the medial side of a rib, there's a little depression right here. We call that the costal groove, or you could call it a costal sulcus. sulcus and groove are the exact same thing. And so there are nerves and blood vessels that course right along with this rib out to the anterior parts of your body. So it's kind of like a nice little passageway. But more importantly, what does this rib do to those blood vessels and nerves that are traveling along with it? They're on the inside? Yeah, it protects those blood vessels and those nerves as well. Okay, that's what this little costal groove is for. Okay. I think one thing that I forgot to mention, which we probably should, is the sacrum. All right, so where do you find the sacrum? Inferior to what? Inferior to the lumbar division of the vertebral column, or superior to the coccyx right here. All right, so you see five vertebrae. You can see these lines of fusion between the vertebral bodies. All right, so is this an anterior view or posterior view of the sacrum? Where do you find bodies, vertebral bodies? They're anterior. What's on a posterior part of a vertebrae? The spinous process, right? So here we see the body. So this is the anterior aspect of the sacrum. Here is the posterior aspect of the sacrum. And between, all right, we have this foramen, the vertebral foramen, but if it lines up with all these different vertebrae, right, it forms a canal, right? So inside, behind these vertebral bodies right here is not the vertebral foramen. We call it the sacral canal. And then way down here at the bottom, there's an opening of the sacral canal down over here. We call that the sacral hiatus. So a hiatus is an opening in something. Now you might notice some foramina within the sacrum. And so these are what we call the posterior sacral foramina. There are nerves that exit the sacrum and go posterior to your body. Not very many because you don't have much body behind your sacrum. Okay. But here are the anterior sacral foramina. They're a little bit bigger, and you can see some of these grooves because you have a lot of nerves that are leaving the spinal cord and moving anteriorly in your body because that's where most of your body is compared to the sacrum. All right, so these are the anterior sacral foramina. These are the posterior. And so don't think of this as a hole going through the sacrum. It's a hole that allows nerves to leave what? The sacral canal. That's why they have two different names and not just one name, because they're actually two different structures. All right, right here is there's like a lip on the sacrum. We call that the sacral promontory. And then here are some articulating processes here and here for what articulates right here, a rib, or what will articulate right here? A vertebrae, like a lumbar vertebrae. Which one? The dinner lumbar one, which is what? Number five. Okay. So this is the superior articulating process and facet that's going to articulate with the inferior articulating process and facet of L5. It's going to come and articulate right here. The other thing that I notice, here is an auricular surface. It's an articulating surface that articulates with your hip bones. And in lab, you're going to see that's a nice smooth surface right here for articulation. It really doesn't move very much. Okay, maybe a little bit sometimes, especially during parturition, but generally it's an immovable joint. All right, so sign-in sheet is going, is the sign-in sheet going around? Anybody have a sign-in sheet? No? Yeah, it's going around someplace. I think I passed it out. I must have passed it out. It looks like this. Ah, it's in the back. Thank you. All right, I was freaking out for no reason. All right, make sure you sign this sign-in sheet, okay, so I know you're here. This is your receipt that you were in class.
For the hiatus, can I put that in a hole in the bone used as a passageway? Can I put that as a hiatus, or?
Like a foramen is a hole anywhere in your body, in particular bone, so a hiatus could be a hole in.
I mean, is it just in the?
There's other hiatuses too.
Okay, so
there's an esophageal hiatus.
Passageway. So
could be a passageway through a muscle, for instance.
Okay. Yeah. And I'll put it on here, so that way
I probably should modify that. Your little list right there.
I like how you have it